Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell review The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman as father and daughter. Florian Zeller adapts it from his play and directs the movie version. A Korean-American family moves from California to a small farm in Arkansas in Lee Isaac Chung's Minari. Stephen Yeun stars and talks with our John Horn later this hour. We're listening to music from Minari's soundtrack, composed by Los Angeles's Emil Mosseri. Another LA-based musician is highlighted in Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. RJ Cutler directs the documentary following the multi-Grammy winner over a few years of her young life. It's Film Week right after NPR News.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. What a great time we had Thursday night with our Film Week and Chill event on The Incredibles. Writer-director Brad Bird and the composer of the score, Michael Giacchino, and our Film Week critics, Claudia Puig and Charles Solomon. By the way, if you want to see that, it's available by visiting kpecc.org/in-person. You can look for the event, and it's archived right there. But let's get to the new films of this week. We begin with The Father, which stars Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. Florian Zeller is the director, and Christopher Hampton and Zeller are the screenwriters. Joining us as critics this week are Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com. Christy, please start us on The Father.
So Anthony Hopkins stars as an ailing 80-year-old. He is suffering from dementia, but when we first see him in his apartment in London, he seems to have a quite tranquil and idyllic life, listening to opera and enjoying the scenery. But then his daughter comes to see him, played by Olivia Colman. And with each conversation that they have, you begin to question what is real. And what's amazing about this film, Florian Zeller directed it, co-wrote it based on his own play of the same name from 2012, a French play that won several awards, is that he puts you in the mind of this gentleman whose name is Anthony. And so you experience his confusion, but he also puts you in the mind of loved ones, caretakers who come and go, who try to help him manage his volatile moods and manage his jumble of memories. And the way this is edited is so subtle, so fluid, it's like a magic trick. You are constantly grasping at what is real and what is true in ways that are simultaneously confusing but also compelling. It's just a beautifully crafted and acted film.
And what an undertaking as you're describing it, Christy. This is just sounds like a huge challenge to have all these different perspectives cohere.
Totally. And the editor won our LA Film Critics Association Award for Best Editing. And what's so amazing about it is that it all takes place within this apartment. And so it kind of feels like a play on film, and yet it's constantly moving and keeping you on your toes, like slight production design changes, like the backsplash in the kitchen or the color of a grocery store bag. And it's just riveting. It accomplishes so much in a relatively short amount of time.
We're talking about The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. Tim, what'd you think?
Oh, yeah. Fantastic, really, this film. Lots of Academy Award sort of expectations here, particularly Anthony Hopkins, I think, and his role playing this old man with this sort of dementia that seems to encompass every possible symptom that this sort of age-related dementias can have. Indeed, from his point of view, and particularly at the beginning of the film, it's as if we're in a horror movie, a thriller or a horror movie or something like that, the way things are changing. And even as we sit there, the way it's scored and lit and the way the camera moves, we feel like we're not sure what is real and what is not. In the same way that he does, he has these visual delusions and hallucinations. Sometimes his daughter is Olivia Colman. Sometimes she's another actress. He keeps thinking that she has told him that she is going to move to Paris, and they get involved in these long arguments. But we see Olivia Colman because from her perspective, she understands what's going on, but it's still just this difficult thing to deal with. You can see how she's has to hold in her emotions. She just wants to grab him by the shoulders and say, remember me. And I imagine that, outside of the boundaries of a play or a movie, that it must be something like that, dealing with someone who's lost in the throes of this sort of dementia.
The Father is the film we're talking about, from director Florian Zeller, who co-wrote it with Christopher Hampton. It's rated PG-13. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. It moves to a wider release in mid-March. And in late March, you'll be able to see it on multiple on-demand platforms. Minari tells the story of a Korean-American family that moves to a small farm in Arkansas. Stephen Yeun stars. It's written and directed by Lee Isaac Chung and rated PG-13. Tim, please tell us about Minari.
A little bit of controversy around this movie having to do with its language and what category can or can't be nominated for at the Golden Globes or at the Oscars and all of that. All of that notwithstanding, I love this beautiful movie, this beautiful little movie, which is set in the Reagan 80s, the early 80s in Arkansas. And I happened to be in Arkansas. I was stationed at an Air Force base, Blytheville Air Force Base in Arkansas, about 1981, 82, exactly when this movie is taking place. And let me tell you, they get all of that exactly right. It sounds like Arkansas. It sounds like the South in the spring and the summer. This family moves from California. They're an immigrant family from Korea, but they've already been to California, where the father and his wife and the kids were living and working. But they immigrate deeper into the heartland of the country. And he wants to start this farm in Arkansas. And meanwhile, they're working at this chicken plant. They're doing chicken sexing, which the wife is not very good at. She's not, generally speaking, happy about this move at all. They have these two little children, including a little boy who has a heart murmur, and they're constantly telling him, "Don't run, don't run." It's a wonderful movie, and it really takes off when the grandmother moves in, who's the exact she's very Korean, and she's the exact opposite of everyone else in the family. She's always trying to get that little boy to run and go outside and play. And what goes on in this film is just this lovely story about this family assimilating into the American culture while at the same time attempting to maintain their culture. It's just the most American of stories that you're ever going to see. It's full of drama. Will Patton is in it, playing this crazy preacher who lives up the street, and he's the kind of guy that I used to run into all the time down in Arkansas way back in the 70s and 80s. And I'm like, man, they just... Now, the director grew up on a farm in Arkansas with his immigrant Korean parents. So he's culling most of this, a lot of this, from his own life. And he's made a beautiful movie, Minari. Minari is a plant. It's this Korean plant, and it's a throwaway line in the movie that the grandmother says, "Minari, you should plant it down by the river. It's hardy. It'll grow." It's just a beautiful, beautiful line from the movie that sort of describes the entire film.
Minari is the film we're talking about. And by the way, Stephen Yeun, who's the star of the film, who plays the patriarch of the family, is in conversation with our John Horn later this hour on Film Week. Christy, what did you think?
Loved it. It's so beautiful. It was on my top 10 list last year. It's a gorgeous film, as Tim said, just the way it's shot and the quiet, observant rhythms of this place. And the score is absolutely gorgeous. And everyone's great in it. You know, it's one thing I love about this way the characters are developed is on paper, they might have all seemed like kind of stereotypical cliched types, like the stoic, hardworking dad and the mom who is a bit of a diva and kind of high maintenance. And then the wacky grandma comes in, and then there's a little kid who's kind of spunky and rambunctious and likes to play pranks. But there is such depth and truth and warmth to all of these people that their relationships and the way that their time in America evolves, it just feels really rich and true. And Young Yoo-jun especially is beautiful in this as the grandmother. Everything changes when she arrives, and she's just full of surprises and full of great humanity. And I got to shout out Alan S. Kim, the little boy who plays the son in this, is incredible. He had never been in a film before. There's no cutesy Disney Channel precociousness about him. He's just got tremendous presence. And every choice here is beautiful and perfect.
Minari, the film rated PG-13. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry, and it's available on multiple on-demand platforms, rated PG-13. The music documentary Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry, is directed by R.J. Cutler. Christy.
Billie Eilish, L.A.'s own Billie Eilish, from down the road from you guys there, yeah. in Highland Park. And I was never really a big fan of her music. I never really got it. I am not an angsty 13-year-old anymore. But I never really understood the allure of her, although I know she became this incredible superstar at a very young age. And this movie really shines a light on what inspires her, what drives her, her focus, her artistry, her collaboration with her brother Phineas, who co-writes and produces all of her songs with her, and just it follows her from like the earliest inklings of stardom and being homeschooled in Highland Park and just making music the primary focus of their lives, and you know, having her songs on the radio at age 15. And just, I mean, she's only 19 years old at this point. I mean, you see her turn 17 at the ice rink in Pasadena. You know, it's a great LA story. It's a fascinating look at how one becomes a musical superstar in this world where things like Spotify and SoundCloud are perhaps more important than getting signed to a big record deal. That's not necessarily the avenue you have to take. It's also a fascinating contrast with the Britney Spears documentary that came out a couple of weeks ago in terms of being a 16, 17-year-old girl just rocketing to superstardom and how that can make or break you depending on the support structure you have all around you. It's not totally worshipful of her. You see her being an angsty teen. You see her being overdramatic about a boyfriend or a phone call or a misunderstanding. But you come away with incredible appreciation for her artistry and her poise and her stage presence. Like a lot of what happens at Coachella and some stage mishaps, and she's just got total like professionalism every time. And I'm not going to say this one thing, but there's a hilarious behind the scenes backstage moment with Katy Perry. That's all I'm going to say.
Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. Tim.
Backstage moment with Katy Perry, man. That's a good enough sentence alone. As Christy says, when we meet Billie, she's 16, turning 17. You know, her main thoughts are about getting herself a Dodge Charger as soon as she possibly can, her boyfriend. And she is living in that little house with her family, and she's not rich. She is famous, though, because you could be famous now before you ever make a nickel. YouTube and all of those kind of things. And she's doing shows. So she has this big, big, big fan base. And she's very, very talented, as is her brother, musically in every possible way. Lovely, lovely voice she has. You know, she has some of the sort of angst displayed that's in her music in the film. But I don't know. It's been 10 years since I've been a high school teacher, since I've been in a classroom. And I can tell you that if I had had this young lady in my class, you know, a dozen years ago, I'd have probably told her, sweetie, you need to relax. Calm down. You're 16.
But then she wouldn't have become a star, right?
I would have ruined her career. I would have completely ruined her career. I'm wondering how many kids' careers are ruined by telling them to relax. Because you know, that angsty music that she writes seems to connect with, you know, obviously, millions and millions of teenagers all around the world. The melodies are lovely. She does have a great voice, and they're all very talented musicians. We hang around with her mother and her father a little bit, and they're lovely people too. As opposed to say like that Amy Winehouse documentary from a few years ago, where simply everyone in her life, her parents or at least her father, were just horrible people. Her boyfriend, everybody was just sucking the life out of Amy Winehouse. This young lady has the exact opposite situation in her life.
Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry documentary from director R.J. Cutler. It's rated R. You can see it streaming on Apple TV Plus, or you can see it on the drive-in screen at the Vineland in City of Industry or the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. Black Holes, The Edge of All We Know, a documentary about the Black Hole Initiative from director Peter Galison. Tim, can you get us started? We've got about a minute and a half.
Oh, I love this movie. It's fantastic. It's full of all sorts of talking heads, theoretical and practical astrophysicists whom most people will never have heard of, except for Stephen Hawking, of course. It's about these two projects. One is called the Event Horizon Telescope Project, which linked a whole bunch of radio telescopes all around the world together, effectively creating one gigantic worldwide size telescope to look at this black hole in a galaxy called M87 in the Sagittarius cluster, at the center of that cluster, and another project called the Black Hole Paradox, run by Stephen Hawking, that had all kinds of theories about how black holes work. This is the place where theoretical physics meet practical physics, and one thing proved the other thing. It's amazing.
Peter Galison's documentary, Black Holes, The Edge of All We Know, is unrated. It is available on demand starting next Tuesday on Apple TV+, iTunes, Google Play, and the Microsoft Store. Coming up, we'll hear about the drama, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson, starring David James Elliott. Also, Cherry, which is a U.S.-Moroccan co-production starring Tom Holland, and Till Kingdom Come, those films and more, on Film Week on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you missed Thursday night's Film Week and Chill, the incredible special program with writer-director Brad Bird, composer Michael Giacchino, and our Film Week critics Charles Solomon and Claudia Puig. It's available for you to see at your convenience, streaming it at home. Just visit kpcc.org/in-person. You'll find the event there, and you can watch our approximately hour-long program. We continue on today's Film Week with our critics, Christy and Tim. Next up is the drama The Obituary of Tunde Johnson, starring David James Elliott and Stephen Silver. It's directed by Ali Leroy and written by Stanley Kalu. Christy, what'd you think of The Obituary?
I really love this movie, and I was so impressed by the way it finds a totally inspired avenue into the very familiar Groundhog Day structure. We see so many movies that have taken that same premise, whether it's Happy Death Day or Edge of Tomorrow. There's so many films that find a horror version or a sci-fi version. This is a Black Lives Matter version of that. But what is fascinating is that the character at the center of it, Tunde Johnson, does not necessarily respond to the Groundhog Day vortex he's finding himself in the way a lot of characters do. So he's this really wealthy Los Angeles teenager. His parents are Nigerian immigrants. And over and over again, he gets pulled over by police and there's a misunderstanding and he gets shot to death. And then he wakes up and lives the same day over again with his vapid friends at his high school in LA. He is gay and closeted. And every day we see different versions of what the relationship is like that he has with his boyfriend, with whom he has this secret love, and also with his best friend, who played by Nicola Peltz. And it's just really clever. It's really thoughtful and eye-opening. There have been so many movies that have taken on the horrific subject of police brutality and violence against Black men. And this finds a totally different way into that. And I was just really impressed by it. Ali LaRoy, this is his first feature. He has been around forever. He co-created Everybody Hates Chris. And he's directed a bunch of episodes of that show and directed a bunch of television. But this is his first feature film he's directed. And there's a great energy and fluidity to the way that it moves. And I was just really impressed by it. So go find it.
The Obituary of Tunde Johnson's Unrated, and you can see it on several on-demand platforms, including Google Play, Apple TV Plus, and Fandango Now. The crime drama Cherry, set in Cleveland, Ohio, stars Tom Holland, Sierra Bravo, and Jack Rayner. Anthony Russo and Joe Russo, who are brothers, are the directors, and it's written by Angela Russo Otstadt and Jessica Goldberg. Tim, tell us about Cherry.
Yeah, the Russo brothers, directorial masters of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, knocked off Winter Soldier and a few other Marvel Universe films. Some of that skill comes in good use here in this movie, Cherry, which is a film that's divided into chapters, one of which is called Cherry, which also happens to be what everybody else in this film calls Tom Holland's character. They call him Cherry. It's all really based on a memoir by a guy named Nico Walker, who was a Iraq War, Vietnam veteran. And he's more or less just telling the story of how he went through his life, went into the war, sort of arbitrarily experienced all that he did there, came back into the world, became a drug addict and a bank robber. When the movie opens, he's already robbing banks, and we sort of meet him. And Tom Holland, his character, kind of speaks to the camera, speaks to us, and sort of says, look, I know this all looks a little nuts, but I'm going to walk you through how I ended up like this. And then we do that. He takes us back to even before he goes off to war. We meet the young woman that he meets that will be a part of his life for the next decade or so. And we see how he ends up joining the army and all that happens that brings us back around to him robbing banks and being a drug addict. It's captivating. The scale sort of sneaks up on you. You're watching this fairly intimate movie, and before you know it, you're in the desert of Iraq, and there are helicopters everywhere, and tanks, and battles, and I suddenly realize why they hired those Russo brothers to direct this movie. It's pretty effective. I don't know that I needed all the gimmicks and for it to be broken up all the way that it's all sort of scattered about like that, but it's a fairly effective little, sort of big crime thriller drama, I guess.
Cherry, the film. Christy, what'd you think?
I feel like Tim and I could spend this entire film week episode today just talking about Cherry, because there's so much going on here. And there's so much to talk about. This is, I think, the kind of movie that the Russo brothers really always want to make. I feel like they took all that clout from the MCU. They directed, Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Endgame. And I feel like they took all of that clout and that goodwill and all that money, and they made the kind of movie that they really, really want to make. It's set in Cleveland, where they're from. So it also feels like they're just throwing everything, every technique at this film that maybe they were constrained from using within the confines of Disney and Marvel and the MCU, and for better and for worse. So there's a lot of incredible camera work, really show-offy, long tracking shots, really elegant, beautiful camera work. Is it in the service of anything beyond just being really impressive? Maybe. Maybe it's to reflect the roller coaster of Cherry's existence. I don't know. But a lot of it is very look at me. You know, a lot of like words on the screen and talking to the camera. A lot of kind of Goodfellas feels like homage to be charitable in terms of the use of voiceover. And, you know, there's a sort of a wry, ironic tone here. I really like Tom Holland in this. I've seen some reviews that say that he is wildly miscast. I really like him stretching to show this. Between this and The Devil All the Time, he's getting a chance to show like a darker side to him. He's adorable as Spider-Man. And of course, he's worked with the Russos as Spider-Man. And he's, you know, got that boyish charm. But there's a lot more going on, and he gets to show the full range of it. It's indulgent. It's sprawling. It's messy. It is like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. But I was never bored. It's really slickly made, and I was into it.
Cherry, starring Tom Holland, from directors Anthony and Joe Russo, is rated R. It's at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry, and in 2 weeks, it'll be available on Apple TV+. The documentary Till Kingdom Come looks at the relationship of evangelical Christians to the state of Israel. Maya Zinstein is the director of the film. Tim?
There's this notion in evangelical Christianity, some in Southern Baptist Christians, a lot of the thought of Protestant, that in order for the end times to be brought on in the state of Israel, Israel must be attacked and the temple must be rebuilt on the Temple Mound. There are all kinds of things that are involved in it, but it is a belief that these evangelical Christians have. Therefore, they believe that they have to be supportive of the state of Israel. And for years and years and years, decades really, they've been donating money all the way back to the founding of the State of Israel. This connection has been there. This film looks at this small town called Binghamton, Kentucky. And there's a Binghamton Baptist Church. And three generations of Binghamtons have been the pastors of that church, leading this particular strain of evangelical congregants in support of Israel for years and years and years. And mostly we spend our time in that town. We go to Israel. The question is posed by the director here. Exactly what is it that these people, these Christians, are in support of? Because in order for all of this to happen, Israel has to be attacked. That's what has to happen. So exactly what is this support about? It's a fascinating story. I've been watching it for a long time growing up as a Southern Baptist sort of Christian when I was a little boy. I've always found it fascinating. The exploration of it here, I think, goes fairly deep. You can tell that the director here has a particular point of view about what's going on, and she's not happy about it.
Till Kingdom Come, the documentary from Maya Zinstein, is unrated, and it's available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The drama The Mauritanian stars Tahar Rahim, Jodie Foster, and Shailene Woodley. Kevin MacDonald is the director, and there are three credited screenwriters. Christy.
It's extremely solid and also feels like maybe it's coming out about 10 years too late. It feels like it's in a bit of a time capsule with a lot of those post 9/11 movies and post Guantanamo Bay movies, but it's really well made and really powerfully acted. Is based on the true story of this man, Mohamedou Ould Slahi, who was imprisoned in Guantanamo. He is the titular Mauritanian, and he is presumed to be one of the 9/11 hijacker recruiters. He spends 14 years in Guantanamo Bay and is horrifically tortured and is never actually charged with anything. Jodie Foster is the lawyer who defends him. Shailene Woodley is her assistant. Benedict Cumberbatch is the government lawyer trying to prove their case. But the deeper he gets into documents and redacted items, he finds that maybe something is going wrong at Guantanamo. And everyone's really good in it. You know, it's a totally solid piece of filmmaking. Kevin MacDonald has done films like The Last King of Scotland, which are a lot more daring from an aesthetic point of view. This is kind of straightforward and kind of solid, and but everyone's good in it. I don't know, Tim.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree completely. It's very straightforward. I do like that when the film opens, we meet this young man in his home in Mauritania. We see him go to temple. We see him laughing and going to a wedding. And it's just so we have this sort of notion of who he is. Kevin MacDonald provides us that before all of the things that happened to him. Now, of course, we're watching this this movie based on a memoir, and we know what happens. What they attempt to do in the context of the film is to bring us back to the day and to give us a feeling of what it meant to be on both sides of this issue, Nancy Hollander's side and as well as the Judge Advocate side. And now from our perspective now, that's a little bit tough to do because, you know, it's not a word that comes out of their mouths that we don't disagree with at this point. And that's a sort of difficult sort of position to provide. So it's not really being the devil's advocate so much per se. Great performances by all of these actors. It's a solid film about what happened, but I don't know that it's fantastic dramatic fodder. That's all.
The Mauritanian, the film starring Tahar Rahim, Jodie Foster, Shailene Woodley, and Benedict Cumberbatch is rated R, and it's available on demand starting next Tuesday. Night of the Kings, a fantasy film starring Bakare Koné, Steve Tinchu, and Letitia Kai, the film written and directed by Philippe Lecote. Christy.
This is such a beautiful and strange movie. And this is the kind of movie that makes me wish we could actually go to theaters right now in LA County, because I would love to have actually seen this. This is from the Ivory Coast. This is shortlisted for the foreign language Oscar, which is really cool because we do not see a lot of movies coming out of that country. And it's just this incredible, magical realism kind of wonder exploration. It takes place in what you think is going to be a horrific setting. It takes place in a prison in Abidjan in Ivory Coast. And it is a place where, like, literally the inmates rule the whole place. And the guards are just kind of there to bring in new prisoners, but they don't really have any actual authority. And within this setting, there is one chief ruler, one inmate who is in charge of everybody in the hierarchy, despite whatever, you know, gangs exist within it. And once the way that it's this very strict set of rules that everybody lives by, and one of them is that once this leader is ailing and no longer able to serve and, you know, rule, he's got to step down before he dies. And what this guy does is he appoints the storyteller. The storyteller is a very, very important role within this prison system. This new guy comes, he's young and skinny and scared, and the ruler says, okay, you are our new storyteller, and you've got to tell us a story and keep it going until dawn on the night of the red moon. And what happens is everyone gathers around, and the moon is indeed high in the sky, and it's red, and he's scared, and he has no idea what to say. And what happens all around him totally organically is that the prisoners begin acting out what he's describing. And they'll drop to the ground in form of an animal, or they'll make noises. And it's this incredibly alive, organic performance. And it's sort of this bizarre combination of like Lord of the Flies with like an improv show. And then in the middle of it.
And a Senate filibuster.
Yeah, totally. It just keeps going till dawn. And then in the middle of it, Danny Levant is there with a chicken on his shoulder. Anyway, it's a trip. It's beautiful and bizarre. Go check it out.
We're talking about the French film Night of the Kings, rated R, written and directed by Philippe Lecote. The film is available through Lemley's Virtual Cinema, as well as multiple on-demand platforms. On demand, it begins next week. We have many more films to review, including The United States versus Billie Holiday, coming next. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We just remind you, if you can't listen to Film Week when it's scheduled on KPCC, you can listen whenever it's convenient for you. Just get it wherever you get your podcasts. It's there. You can also find it at kpcc.org. We archive each week's program there as well. I'm joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire. Next up is The United States versus Billie Holiday. Lee Daniels directs. Suzanne Laurie Parks wrote the screenplay of the film. It's adapted from Johann Hari's book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. Andra Day stars as Billie Holiday. Tim, tell us about this film, please.
Well, it's a very, very strong film that mostly hangs on Andra Day's performance. It's a very, very naked performance, both literally and metaphorically in every possible way as she channels Billie Holiday. She's a wonderful singer, so she can do all of that, but she has to do the acting part too. This is new for her. And the smart thing that she and I suppose Lee Daniels figure out is don't try to imitate her. Don't do that. Just sort of inhabit the space that she inhabited because of the life that she lived. And in the film, Lee Daniels and the writers show us the life that Billie Holiday lived, including this very particular period in her life where the Department of Narcotics was going after her as hard as they possibly could. Now, what they were really trying to do was to make her stop singing that song, Strange Fruit, which had become an important song in the sort of pre or nascent civil rights movement. Most of this is happening in the middle 50s. And there were many, many people who wanted her to stop singing that song. Billie Holiday, as addled as she was by drugs and the treatment of by most of the men in her life, her pimp husband and other ne'er-do-wells who would come into her life, she had a resilience about that thing at least. She couldn't overcome the heroin, but she would sing that song every time she got a chance when she knew that they were going to storm the stage and arrest her. There's a lot that's going on in this movie. Some other really good performances, including Trevante Rhodes playing an actual character, a fellow named Jimmy Fletcher, who really was the first federal agent in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, who was a spy, basically. He went into Billie's entourage and became acquainted with her, even started dating her, and he was ratting her out the entire time. That's a very, very complicated story that's sort of presented in a particular way in this film that I don't think holds to the reality of this. I've read a whole lot about this. Nevertheless, it's the story, the way they decided to tell it. Again, it all hangs on Andra Day's performance. She's fantastic in this movie.
She's from Southern California, by the way, from San Diego. I'm a big fan of her as a singer. I haven't seen her act, but does she get to sing in the film, Tim?
She does. Very interestingly, she even sings Strange Fruit. She sings all the standards. Strange Fruit is not the song, though, that the film is hung on. There are several other Billie Holiday standards. And the way she performs the Billie Holiday's pieces so subtly. She only does that little Billie Holiday drawl every now and again, so that you do not get the sense of an imitation going on. But you always understand that is Billie Holiday.
All right. The United States versus Billie Holiday. Christy.
Yeah, Andra Day is amazing, and she's far and away the best part of this movie. And it's amazing to think that she hadn't really acted before. You know, as you say, Larry, she is primarily a singer. She's best known for this giant hit, Rise Up. And she had never acted. And so I would imagine it would be quite daunting to play somebody who is as legendary as Billie Holiday. And you're right, Tim, she's not doing exactly, it's not exact mimicry. It's not an exact imitation. She gets the phrasing and just kind of the vibe and maybe like the raspiness a little bit. But what was very surprising to me about this is that given that Lee Daniels made this, that it's such a safe music biopic, structurally, tonally, in terms of its superficiality. I mean, it literally has this framing device where Billie Holiday is doing an interview with somebody in the beginning, and then it flashes back to her telling stories about various portions of her life. And then every once in a while, it comes back to the interview and then goes back into the flashbacks. And given this is somebody who has given us some really, really daring films like Precious, like The Paperboy, I was just shocked that Lee Daniels made, I mean, it's not like Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. It's not that traditional in its biopic tropes, but it's pretty safe, and again, a lot of it, a lot of the allure of it has to do with Andra Day's performance. She really carries it through when it threatens to be pretty standard otherwise.
The United States versus Billie Holiday is unrated, and it's streaming on the Hulu service. The Vigil, a horror thriller starring Dave Davis and Fred Melamed, is written and directed by Keith Thomas. Christy?
This is a horror movie that takes place within the Hasidic community of Brooklyn. And Dave Davis plays this young man who is trying to kind of make his way away from the faith. And at the beginning, kind of fascinatingly, he's meeting with young people who also previously had been, you know, deeply within or raised within the Orthodox tradition. And they're trying to learn to live in the secular world and basic things like dating and writing a resume and how do you navigate that. And that's really interesting. But then he gets sucked back in when he is asked by a gentleman he knew, played by Menasha Lustig, who starred in a film called Menasha, which was very good a few years back, to serve as a shoimer, which is somebody who stays up all night with somebody who is deceased. You stay in the room with the body, stay awake to make sure that no evil spirits come after it. And so this young man needs the money and takes the job and has to stay up all night in this apartment in Borough Park in Brooklyn with this dead body. And if that is not a premise for a horror movie, I don't know what is. And what happens is it's supernatural, but it's also the guilt that within him over what happened, which is, explains why he left the Orthodox faith. And they accomplish so much here with what's clearly a low budget and basically one location. And it is quite terrifying. Yeah, quite subtly terrifying.
The Vigil, rated PG-13, at the Vineland Drive-In and Industry, Arena Cine Lounge, Hollywood, and on multiple on-demand platforms. The thriller Crisis stars Gary Oldman, Armie Hammer, and Evangeline Lilly. It's written and directed by Nicholas Jarecki. Tim?
Yeah. So this movie is a thriller, and it's sort of this dramatic movie organized around drug traffickers and an undercover cop played by Armie Hammer, and this mother played by Evangeline Lilly, who's kind of a drug addict herself, but her son gets involved with some things, and he gets killed, and she wants to find out what happened to him. And then you have this other movie over here with Gary Oldman, who's a scientist working for this gigantic corporation, and they have this drug that they're making, and the drug is supposed to make not allow. It's a painkiller, and it's supposed to make sure that people do not get addicted to this painkiller. And they're, you know, obviously they're sort of pointing themselves at the opioid addiction that's happened here. And it's all very interesting, except that it feels like we're watching two or sometimes even three different movies that are all only loosely connected by this notion that these drugs are bad and drug companies are bad. And, you know, so it's a little bit too all over the place and a few too many movies trying to be contained in this for it all to come together and gel and make sense.
Crisis is rated R and it's in select theaters, also available on Fandango Now starting next Tuesday. And finally, Moxie, a comedic drama starring Atlee Robinson, Alicia Pascual Pena, and Lauren Tsai. Amy Poehler, the director of the film. Christy, can you give us a quick minute on Moxie?
Yes, this takes place in a high school where Amy Poehler, who also co-stars, has a 16-year-old daughter played by Hadley Robinson, and it's the beginning of the new school year, and so everyone is subjected to the rankings by the jerk football players and popular kids, and it's all about how the young women at this high school decide that they are tired of being objectified, they are tired of the sexism and the misogyny, and this young woman writes this underground zine anonymously, where she refers to herself as Moxie and kind of rallies all the other kids to think for themselves and speak for themselves and not tolerate that kind of treatment anymore. Ideologically, I am down with this completely, but it's very on the nose, and then everyone says what they want to say, and then they go woo over and over and over again. So okay. It's a little repetitive.
Moxie is rated PG-13, and it starts streaming on Netflix next Tuesday. For our Film Week critics, Tim and Christy, I'm Larry Mantle. Stay tuned. Coming up next, I'll lead you right into John Horn, his conversation with actor Stephen Young.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidi, it's an Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. The new film Minari tells the deeply personal story of a Korean-American family that moves to a farm in Arkansas. Writer-director Lee Isaac Chung was inspired by his own experience. Stephen Yeun stars as the patriarch, and our John Horn got the chance to talk with Yeun about the film.
A lot of people call the film Minari, but in Korean it's called Minari. I've talked to people who say, which character is Minari? Is it the guy? Is it the son? Who is Minari? And I go, Minari's not a person, it's a thing. And it's really important. How would you describe what Minari is?
Minari is a plant that, you know, in our story is planted by the grandmother. And it's a very beautiful metaphor that this plant kind of carries. And I can't speak too much about it in terms of, it's not personal to me like it was to Isaac, but the story that I hear Isaac tell is that it was the plant that his grandmother brought over and planted in their farm when they had their farm. And all the years that they tried to grow all these other things, in the end, the thing that thrived the most was his grandmother's Minari.
There are actors who really discover character sometimes through piece of costume, you know, a pair of shoes. Some actors discover character through eyeglasses or props. But I'm wondering about the land itself, because you play a farmer. Being in that land, touching the earth, being amongst the crops, how does that change you as a performer in that environment? And what does it do in terms of how you feel like you are that person?
Right before we started filming, I found Wendell Berry's The Farm, which is a beautiful, beautiful poem that he wrote. And in one particular section, and I'm going to butcher this, so I apologize to Wendell Berry, but he writes, "And the land is what it is, and it has included you in its work." And that was very profound to me, that it wasn't a man separate from nature, but it was someone just of nature and of process, and that the acts and works that he was doing wasn't necessarily seeable or projected so that everybody else could see what he was doing, but it was just part of how the land was being changed and made by him, but also in and of itself.
I think what's interesting about Minari is you can define what it is, but you can really define what it isn't. And what it isn't is a story about assimilation, barriers, racism, a story about immigrants as seen by whites or others. This is a story about a family. They happen to be immigrants, but that's not the point of the story. And it's a story about intergenerational relationships, like how you see your parents and how your children see you. And that's so rare that that story is not framed by the way that that typical story is told.
Yeah, I really appreciate you seeing it that way. That was our intention. It really was an inside look at the point of view from this family. And, you know, when you're looking at it from the inside, you're not necessarily processing or trying to, you know, understand yourself or explain yourself through the larger societal processes that, you know, try to understand and capture you in a box. And so this really, if anything, if this story is a story about assimilation, it's really about a story, it's really about a family assimilating to itself and to each other.
Part of what makes this story so universal that relationships and families are always a balancing act. And what your character's family is going through is the balancing act that so many people face every minute of every day. Like, who wins, basically? And what are the priorities and what's the goal of what we're doing together?
The most profound thing that I connected with for me internally was really getting at the ways in which families, but even larger, just all of us in this shared experience of living on this planet, in all the ways that we miscommunicate to each other, and in all the ways that we miscommunicate love to each other. And I think for my character, Jacob, the journey that he goes on is understanding that the ways in which he tries to communicate love, which is through duty and roles, sometimes it doesn't land in the ways that he thinks it does. And the family doesn't feel part of the process, even though they are. And I think, you know, Jacob comes to learn by the end, hopefully, that he's not living this individual existence that bears the burden of this family on his shoulders. This family is not his property. They're not offshoots of his life, but it's this collective experience that he's having with his family together, and that he should recognize how much burden everyone else is also carrying with them in this journey.
In thinking about your acting career and what led you up to this role, there are certain things that prepare you for a part like this, and probably certain things that you're not quite prepared for. The growth you had to go through, or the challenges this part presented to you, how would you define them? What were the biggest creative challenges for you as a performer playing Jacob?
We were touching on a story by the second generation of the prior generation, but not from our own lens. And I think that's a key distinction. I think usually when we do see films by Asian Americans that have our parents in there, sometimes the way they're written is from our point of view, and they're limited, or they're lionized, or they're infantilized, or they're romanticized. But really, it was the internal process of breaking down what I knew for myself and what I held as right and true, and say, maybe that's not true. Maybe your dad is not what you thought he was, or he's not a sum of your projections. Maybe your father's generation is not these larger concepts, but really is very similar to who you are. To come to an understanding between, you know, my immigrant father and myself, who has spent the last 30 years slowly kind of being separated from each other through language, culture, and so many other barriers that separate our generation. It was really beautiful, but initially terrifying to understand that, you know, I am my father, and that, you know, I am deeply connected to him, and I can see it through his eyes as well. And so, that type of journey was the thing that was difficult to touch.
I'm going to take you back to January 26th of last year at the Library Center Theater in Park City, Utah. It was the first screen of the film. I was there. And I believe you were sitting with your dad. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And had he seen the film before?
No.
What was that like?
It was amazing. I mean, for him to watch it and then and then for us to kind of embrace and cry and go through all these emotions at the end of it. I think I'm very thankful for the connection that it started. And I'm also thankful that we were able to communicate a feeling that was never able to be captured in words. And, you know, that continues to be something very beautiful that we celebrate.
That's our John Horn talking with Steven Yeun, who stars in Minari, the film available now to stream on video on demand platforms. I want to remind you, you can listen to all the episodes in full of Film Week wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.